Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman. And I believe that Doug Millar will be joining us as a co-host tonight as well, all the way up from Alaska tonight. Doug, you have a live mic if you'd like to say hello. Doug may be muted. You've got a live mic on my end, Doug, if you can hear me. So you can jump in here whenever you would like to. Our guest tonight is a great Colorado compatriot of mine and friend, Harry Talbot. And we're just looking forward to getting into this discussion. But as always, we always like to open this show with a prayer. Almighty Father, we just want to thank you so much for the wonderful moisture you've been bringing us here on the Front Range of late. We're just thankful that we can turn to you, and we know that your spirit is joining us here in this show, Walls in Our Minds. We always ask that everything we do glorifies you and that you take control and that we bring forward a message that is pleasing to you. We ask you to open the eyes and hearts of our listeners and help us to bring forward a message that is in accordance with your will. It's in the name of your son, Yahshua HaMashiach, that we pray. Amen. Well, I think Doug may have had a bad connection. He actually dropped back off, so I'm sure he'll join us here shortly. But let me introduce Harry Talbot to our listeners. Harry, say hello, and please give us a little bit of background on how you got to be an activist and what you and your family have been doing for several generations, and just bring us forward on what's happening with you and your world.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. I'm talking from my office here at Talbot's Mountain Gold, and it's a family company, and we pack and ship and grow Colorado fruit, and we have a fairly major operation. We ship and pack for a lot of other growers beside our own orchards, and you'll probably see our peaches pretty soon in the stores under Talbot's Mountain Gold. And I'm sitting here. I have a little library behind me, and the library is what I call my power library. And it's stocked with books of people who have thought about the issue of power and how people get power and how they resist power, how they arm themselves against power. And I got started on this quest a number of years ago when I realized I wasn't doing very well. I had some land battles to fight and so on. And so I got the idea of studying the writings of people who really knew, you know, who didn't get their butts kicked all the time. And guys like Eric Hoffer, who wrote The Tree Believer, and Swan Tzu, who wrote The Art of War, and Green and Elfers, who wrote The 48 Laws of Power. And I've been reading books like I just read Red Beckman's book, Walls in Our Minds, so I'm fresh from reading that. And that's one that you gave me when you were a guest at my house, and I had a very great time talking to you and learning from you. And so I've been studying, we've been winning a lot of battles over here. You know, we just got a sheriff candidate to resign yesterday, so that was one of our latest victories. And this guy was kind of a corrupt guy, and we went after him, our group did, and we've won many battles over here. And so I like to share with people how we've done it and why it's important.
Well, tonight's my chance to learn from you, Harry. Because when people are guests on my show, I like to be quiet as much as possible and listen to them. And I'm
okay.
hoping that Red's going to join us here shortly. And
okay, well,
it's if you'd like to launch right out into talking a little bit about there's Red now. Let's get him on here and say hello.
Hello
Red.
This
Beckman.
Is Red.
Hello, Red.
Hello there.
Red. Say hello.
Good talking to you.
To Harry Talbot, Red.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
We hear
very,
you fine.
Very well.
Yeah. I just love to be a little closer to some of them peaches you've got.
Well,
I love peaches.
There are people over here who have dreamed about owning a peach orchard since they were a kid. Isn't that amazing?
I had a brother up in Idaho, and he had some peaches, but he gave up on them. He didn't. He wasn't commercial, of course. He said he had to spray them too much, and I don't know whether they had a disease problem or what, but he's gone now.
They may have. Yeah. That's better country for apples there. But
yeah.
We have an area here that is particularly suited to peaches. If we can get through the winters and the spring frost, then we have wonderful crops here. And we do have a good crop this year. So
that's good. I'm glad to hear that. And I think my brother said that the guys that tried to grow peaches there had trouble. If they had a bitter cold winter, it would kill the trees.
That's probably the limiting factor there. The peach trees won't take a lot of cold.
Yeah, they will freeze and I guess they pop, they split or what, I don't know. But he said you'd go out on a real cold night and like this last winter, they had quite a bit of really bitter cold.
Yeah.
And in the Boise area, so I'm sure it was hard on the peach trees, what peach trees they have anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we have been having cooling temperatures for 18 years, and the warmest year, of course, here of the decade of the 1900s was 1934. And in the 40s, when I was a kid, we had warm seasons every year, and we had cherries and apples and peaches and pears and apricots, and we thought that's the way it was always going to be. And then the climate started changing, and our growing season started getting shorter and maybe drier and colder, and that's where we are now. So
Al Gore didn't help you a bit.
No, you'd think all the hot air out of Washington would make a difference, but I guess it goes the other way.
Yeah.
So we have a very good life here, and of course we have our issues with the government and everything, and that is one reason that we've been studying, and learning from you guys on, what our rights are and how to deal with the regulatory people and so on, and it's helped us quite a bit. So,
I don't think of all the places in this country, I can't think of any time that we ever had a meeting where I spoke in Grand Junction, Colorado. I was in the Denver area a number of times, and and all, but I don't ever remember. I've gone through there a lot of times because we put about 50,000 miles a year on our van,
okay.
And, you know, just traveling the country for 30 years. And,
yeah.
But I don't ever remember a meeting in Grand Junction.
I'll have you meet with our Mesa County Patriots sometime.
One thing that has happened, there's some that have set up a speakerphone or whatever, and I speak to some large groups right from my home, you see, and because I'm not traveling very much. I've got a subpoena in the mail here that I have to look at to appear at a tax trial, but it's not that far away. It's about a day's drive, and I will try to make that because it has the potential of being kind of a breakthrough for us. We're going to have to intimidate the judge, of course, initially, because it's been quite a while since they let me testify in federal court, because the judges won't, when they find out who I am, why they won't let me testify. However, now that we understand how to control these judges, we're going to be trying, the public defender is working with me on this, and that's kind of a surprise. We'll see how it works. We've had such a breakthrough, I think, with information just the last couple of years, and you're going to be hearing about it.
We need it very much. Can't come too soon for us.
I keep telling people, they say, better late than never. But my first book came out in 1980, and I'll tell you, I was saying the same thing then that I'm saying now, except now we've gone another step with it. And this is the one that's going to put these judges, put them out of business almost as far as them controlling everything from the bench.
Yeah.
It's real simple.
And using some kind of law like statutory or admiralty law or something, right?
No, this here, you see, all of these judges, all these renegade public servants are all paid from tax money. They are beneficiaries of the tax law. That's just simple. That's just a simple truth. They're beneficiaries of the tax laws, and in particular in tax cases. However, even in traffic cases, it has been working because so many of these cities and towns now are trying to raise revenue using traffic fines and such, and they pay the traffic court judge, they pay him from the money he collects in fines, which means he has a conflict of interest, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And that's not, that they can't deny it. They cannot deny it, you just put the judge on judicial notice that he has a conflict of interest and that if he makes any findings of fact or conclusion of law, he's going to have to face a common law jury, Seventh Amendment common law jury, which is the highest court in the land, and he's going to have to face that in a Title 42. And, boy, I'll tell you, you got their attention right quick.
Well, you're writing down the procedures for doing that, right?
No, I haven't. I just tell people on the phone what to do. And it's so simple. You see, that's been part of our problem. We let the lawyers and the politicians confuse us. I better let Terry take off. He's the head honcho on this show, so.
Okay.
It's easy to get carried away.
I know.
Well, I'd like to mention a couple of things. One, we're welcoming the Crusade Radio folks here with us tonight. We are simulcasting, and Jim, so you know, if Doug's on there with you, you do have a live mic. I tried to give him a kudo earlier, and he had dropped off, so I assume he's on with you now. Right, Jim?
Yep, he should be here.
I'm here.
All right. Well, you guys do have a live mic, so if it gets noisy, I'll mute you. But in the meantime, you've got it on open mic. Red, you've got an opportunity here with Harry Talbot. You might be able to do some bartering. You know, Harry just read your book, Walls in Our Minds, and, you know, I bet you could get him to ship you some peaches if you'd ship him some books.
I'll take you.
Yeah,
on
that that's you know, I would trade some books, I guess. I would trade. We get about $35 plus postage and handling on The Law That Never Was, Volume One, and we have shipped a lot of them recently. This is so much fun now. And I had a call today, a fellow tried to use the 16th Amendment fraud, illegal ratification or no ratification at all, and he tried to use it, and they shut him off. And he said, man, he said, you ought to see all the cases that they used to build up their side of the argument. And I said, well, did it ever dawn on you that you should check on all those cases that they have cited? And I said, you will find that every single case that is in the law books, every single case, it is done by a judge who is a beneficiary of the tax laws. Therefore, he cannot make findings of fact or conclusions of law because he has a conflict of interest, and the judicial code of ethics is very, very clear. If they have a conflict of interest, they have to step back. They can't proceed. And so, they have fooled us. They have played games, some mental games, and everything. I know when I started way back in the mid-70s fighting this system, I filed my first federal action in July of 77. They had us believing that we had to use all the case law and the rules and regulations in the code and the federal rules of civil procedure and all that. That was all a fraud. The Seventh Amendment just says very clearly, if there's a controversy of over $20, the right to trial by a jury, a Seventh Amendment common law jury, is the remedy. And boy, I'll tell you, we missed, for all these years. And now it's going to break. And, of course, I think that our Heavenly Father he's the best source of wisdom that there is. And I think he's helping us now in a way that we have not had in the past, perhaps. So anyway,
I would agree. How do we keep informed of this stuff that you're doing now?
Well, you see, if you've got a group, get some of them together, the people that are fighting these cases, and just give me a set of time when you want to call, and then you can have a speakerphone or whatever. I don't know how you. You know, and I'll explain it. It's so simple. You see, they've got it so complicated. Case law and statute law is so complicated. It's just absolutely absolute nonsense. And you got a lot of case law that contradicts each, you know, other cases. And so it's a great way for a lawyer to make, you know, fools of us. And they've sure done that. But it wouldn't very long.
And intimidated us.
Yeah, they did. They sent a lot of our innocent people to jail.
And there's a lot of uninformed jurors out there, and it's really important that we get people informed on how important their vote in the jury box is, and that they have the right to nullify bad law, and they have the right to judge law.
Yeah.
Harry, you've you've brought up this term sovereign tonight, and we've seen a lot of people go out there and try to proclaim that, hey, I'm a sovereign, I'm a free man. And basically it usually ends up landing them in the pokey someplace because they really don't understand the common law game. So I'm really curious to hear you talk about how a person, an individual, can bring forward their power to exercise their sovereign power as an individual. And I'm anxious to hear that.
Well, I can get part way there. But let me start this way. My son gave me a book to read recently called The Seven Tipping Points That Saved the World, and it's by a couple of Stewarts, Chris and Ted Stewart. And in the book, they have an interesting question. How many people have lived in freedom in the history of the world? And so they quote the Freedom Institute, which says that there have been about 100 to 110 billion people, they think, have lived on the earth since the beginning of mankind. And they think that about 3 billion of the current population lives in free nations. Now, and then they estimate that 554 million people have lived under freedom in the United States since 1780. And he said we can postulate another billion or fewer have lived under freedom in other European nations. So their estimate is that over time that only about 3 to 4.5%, depending on how you do your math, have lived in freedom. So this is kind of shocking. So this means that the average person is either powerless or feels powerless. And I know that when I talk to people in the United States who are unhappy, you know, people around me about what's going on, they don't feel they have any power to, you know, they say, what can you do? And so I've taken on that challenge, and I have written some stuff here. Of course, I teach people the 48 Laws of Power, which is another subject that we'll talk about a little later. And so what I tell them, I kind of follow Badnarik's idea of when you wake up in the morning, you've got to say it's good to be king, you know, before you get up, which is what I do. And that starts affecting your mind, because if your mind does not believe that you're sovereign, if you cannot believe that, you will not act as though you're sovereign, and other people will not treat you as though you're sovereign. And in my paper here, I say the oppressors know that their most potent weapon is the mind of the oppressed. They don't really control us as much as we empower them. We must take control of our own minds, and in so doing, we will not fight them, we will simply withdraw our consent for them to control us. So you see how that works. And so then I go back to a statement I heard years ago. Ralph Nader said they couldn't do it to us if we wouldn't let them. And, you know, I got to thinking about what does this mean. And so I started thinking what are things that an average person, this is a person who is not bold, it's a person who is, you know, an average person that doesn't want to get involved in stuff very much but would like to have a better life and make a difference, what can they do as a group. So I start out my paper by saying, quoting Benjamin Disraeli, he says, "For you see, the world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes." And then Judge Frankfurter, Felix Frankfurter, said, "The real rulers of Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes." And Woodrow Wilson said, "There is a power somewhere so organized, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." And so he was the guy, you know, that we can thank for signing the Federal Reserve Act and getting us getting us started with all of the things like the IRS and this illegal banking system that controls our money. So the problem, as I stated here, is how do a few thousand people control over 300 million, and who is the beast, and how does it control our country? And most people despair of ever doing anything to affect change to get our country back as a constitutional republic where freedom reigns. And this paper presents a method for empowering an individual to do things with, and these are things within the means of everybody. And we got where we are by playing by their rules. We will no longer play by their rules, but our rules. If we practice things, I will show you. And this is me and my hubris. It is we who will become sovereign. It is we who will escape their debt and death cycle. If we continue to play by their rules, anything we do or any organization will ultimately fail. Our effort, and it's like what Red was saying about the courts, you know, we play in by their rules, we lose. And it'll be, our efforts will be like building sandcastles, which will be swept away by the next tide. And these will, this system that I propose has to do with small changes that a person can make in their daily life. And I said, let's look at the ways that the beast controls us. And the beast controls us by, starting in 1913, Congress passed a law allowing privately owned banks to have complete control over our money. The banks are literally above the law. They can print money, set the value and the amount of money, and they are not subject to audit so far, except for in a small way, are not accountable to the people of the United States. And these same people are the originators of the most complicated tax system in the history of the world, over 80,000 pages. The system is used to enslave us by controlling our daily lives in great detail. And it says our combination has created financial slavery for almost all Americans. We've become desensitized to everything, to unprecedented monetary policy, record debts, massive wealth gaps, government surveillance, theft, deceit, and inflation. And, you know, we it's kind of like the boiling frog scenario that we've heard about before, that we're the frog that's getting slowly heated up. And then we are enslaved by lengthy and complicated laws which result in millions of regulations under which we must conduct our daily lives. This greatly limits our constitutional rights and keeps us from making many decisions that we believe would make our lives better. And we are enslaved by debt and so on. And then I'm skipping down a little. We are enslaved. Our minds are enslaved by the mainstream media, who control us by limiting the information we get to what the owners of the media want us to have, disinformation, so they get to decide our values and what we think is important. And the beast, and so the beast can control our actions. And I look at the news media, I call them the prestitutes, and I think of the newsberg, and it's like a giant iceberg, and what they want us to see and hear is above the water, and what they don't want us to see and hear is below the water. And So we are enslaved by a monopolistic government system that also controls our minds and dumbs us down. And one of the things I think about is, you know, I tell people that your citizenship is really Colorado, that you're a Colorado citizen, and your constitution is the Colorado Constitution. And in my case, I fly the Colorado flag. And, you know, if we were a rational society that understood our constitution, our schools would be flying our state flags instead of the national flag. And so we would not be flying the federal flag except on federal facilities. We would not, for example, consider that the Forest Service and the BLM own the land in Colorado that they administer. Most people don't know that the land is owned by the state of Colorado and administered under a proprietary arrangement by the BLM and the Forest Service. And as I understand it, they don't have police power on that land. So these are the kind of things. Why is the governor of a state called the governor instead of the president of the state? See, if we're a sovereign state with a constitution, why do we not have some sort of a monetary system in our state that allows us to have a choice so that we are not enslaved? The state would have the power to keep us from being enslaved by the Federal Reserve system. And so the question is, are we doomed to be perpetual slaves? You know, as 95 to 97% of the world have been, in a sense, over the years. Are we helpless against this monster, or can we turn this around and become independent thinkers in control of our own lives? The answer is yes, if we are really willing to do this. And then these are my humble suggestions here. And so we are dealing with monopolistic practices, multiple laws. We're dealing with surveillance. You know, we get these smartphones and everything, and they can track us where we live and what communications we make and so on. So I'm going to suggest that there are ways that we can starve the monster. And the first way we do is we starve the media by refusing to listen to it. Now I'm talking about the mainstreams. Cancel your cable or your satellite. The monster uses these to direct your thinking. And you probably remember back when they changed to digital TV, and the government advertised for months that you've got to get your converter, you know, and then they had some subsidies for converting. And I'm thinking, why are they doing this? And they're doing it because this is the mind control mechanism, is the TV, and all of the subliminal messages in the TV are things like, you know, we can use a SWAT team to open your house up if we need to with no warrant or anything. The feds trump the state guys and the local guys, the women trump men, black women trump white men. There are dozens of themes like this, and not to mention things like the gay and the gay agenda and all of these things. And then number two, and when I'm, you know, if you guys can add some more stuff to this or alter them so they're better, this is a work in progress. So more of those who move jobs overseas by buying mostly things made in America by Americans. And there's a guy named Roger Simmermaker who wrote a book on how Americans can buy American. And he has a website, and you'd be surprised how much you can buy in America. And it wouldn't take a lot of change to make all the difference in the world. And you strengthen your body and your wallet by growing part of your own food. Have a good-sized garden or partner with others in gardening. Learn how to eat healthy food. Keep yourself physically fit. And that's become even more important, you know, since the new health care laws are in some stage of being implemented now. Now this one I had a little trouble with, but I can explain it. It's that you starve the military. The beast needs American troops in many countries to protect the interests of international businesses that are located there. And I should add, to project power around the world. You remember going back from Roosevelt's Great White Fleet that moved the battleships to different countries to say, you know, this is what we're going to do to you if you don't comply with our wishes. And now the aircraft carriers, I saw the other day where one of the big aircraft carriers was anchored in the harbor at Athens, the Piraeus Harbor. And I'm thinking, you know, that's pretty intimidating. And then they get the people from the local government there in Athens to go aboard the ship. And, you know, when they come back, they're impressed and they're thinking, well, we don't have a chance against this guy. So the beast gets many young Americans killed who think they are defending freedom. We defend freedom at home. That's a statement. We defend freedom at home. The Swiss, who are armed to the teeth, have real home defense. And I believe that our model should be home defense. And the Colorado Constitution, Article 17, says that the Colorado militia is every male between 18 and 45. Well, who's brought that into the discussions on the ability to bear arms? We should not only be bearing arms, but maybe the state should be providing us with those arms or enabling us to have those military-grade arms. General Smedley Butler, Commandant of the Marine Corps, says that the only two things worth defending are the Bill of Rights and our borders. And he was a famous old Marine general, if you remember. And then number five is connect with your faith and make certain that you teach that faith to your children in your home. And then I say put on the full armor of God, which is Ephesians 6, 12 to 18. Daily seek the guidance of the Holy Spirit. And then starve the public schools that are set up to teach conformity. These are what I call the conveyor belt schools. You know, everybody gets on the belt and goes at the same speed and comes off the end of the belt with pretty much a conformist. And to obey, to teach conformity and to obey authority. If possible, move your children to private schools or homeschool them. My son Charlie says that since he sent his kids to public school, he should be convicted of child abuse. So that's, you know, his position. Don't allow the state to bully you. It will take courage, but you can spend part of your education learning about the U.S. Constitution and your state constitution and learn your rights under the law. For example, study your rights as a juryman. Take a bold stand for freedom in your everyday life. Pay your income taxes only at the end of the tax year. Do not pay withholding taxes. And eight, get out of debt and pay your bills with cash. The banking system is debt-based, and the means they use to control us is debt. Get out of the stock market. It is a rigged system. A Dave Ramsey system will show you how to live debt-free. And some of you probably heard the Dave Ramsey show. He's very good at getting people out of debt and on the right track. Be careful what you read. Most popular magazines and newspapers are lacking in content and in most cases are loaded with disinformation. They are part of the brainwashing. I call them chewing gum for the mind. I've gone into stores like Barnes & Noble where they have 400 different magazines on the rack and I have challenged myself to find something that has good, solid, either religious or conservative content. And it's almost impossible to find. And be very cautious how you use electronic communication. It is being increasingly monitored, stored, and at some point in the future may be used against you. And many people have found this to their sorrow. And nine, do not assume guilt for anything that was done by your race or ancestors to any group in past history. You are not responsible for what they did. And I was interested in Red's comment in the book Walls in Your Minds, you know, about give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And he said, I don't owe anything to Caesar. He died a long time before I came on Earth. So I thought that was pretty good or pretty funny. And then he pointed out that that this was tribute, which we do not pay. And so, if I understood it correctly, don't get involved in drugs or pornography. The proceeds from these two consist of one of the major sources of food for the beast. And I think one of the major reasons that they don't close the border is it would stop the drug trade, and there are high-placed people who are involved in drug trade, and they don't want that to slow down. Work hard to keep your family strong. Good families are much less dependent on the beast, and the beast fears them. And 12, study and be familiar with the U.S. and your state constitutions, and you must become a true self-reliant citizen. And now, some of you probably know Jeff Wright. I studied some constitutional stuff under him. We had some of these guys come to Palisade and teach us, like Michael Gaddy and Jeff Wright. And he said the restoration of the Republic is entirely dependent on individual citizens reasserting their power as sovereign beings. And we must return to the foundational principles that self-governing individuals and families are the essential building blocks, and where all of us are free to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To sum it up, the psychopaths and sociopaths who have run the world for centuries now have new tools to control us. If you get swept up into their debt and death cycle, you will, without realizing, give up your ability to be a free man. Withdraw your passive consent. Don't get swept up in the movements. Control your own mind and teach those within your circle of influence to do the same. And that's pretty much my thinking on that. So maybe you guys have some thoughts on that.
Well, I have.
By the way, we've had Jeff.
Go ahead.
We've had Jeff Wright. We interviewed Jeff on the show just under a year ago, as I recall. And Jim, feel free to jump in with your comment.
Well, I just wanted to say a couple of things to some of the comments you had made about, first, the televisions. You're absolutely right. When they changed the televisions over to digital, each television is equipped with not only listening devices, but also with two-way send and receive. So every cable system can send information as well as receive it. When you buy things at a store, whether it be with credit card or whatever, they know what you're buying. And you'll notice there's a trend going on with your TV. All of a sudden, you start getting programs with items that you've bought. And this is with digital cable and understanding how digital signal works. You can pile, I'd say, 100 different signals on one line. So they can send different advertisements to different houses. And each house would find out that they have bought things that they're being advertised for. But essential to that is the fact that they can send and receive. So they can turn on the TV at any time, and in the future you'll notice your TV will come on, and they'll give you an emergency warning of a tornado or a UN is coming into our country, whatever emergency they want. That's a number one, okay, which I wanted to support that. And some of the other things which escape me right now, things that you had said that they are doing is absolutely right on.
Well, good. I wanted to make this so a person could do it that really didn't want to get involved in public life in any way.
Well, those are some very basic principles that obviously have been ignored. The whole, I mean, it requires, first of all, that that somebody has taught these things, because the people today don't understand these principles that people 50 years ago took for granted, and that was a part of the problem. They took some of these values, these tenets, these principles and precepts that really built the foundation of this nation, of this federation, I should say.
Federation.
It's been lost. This knowledge of discipline has been lost, and it's not been taught to us in the churches either. It's another way that the churches have failed.
Yeah, I read that in Walls in Our Minds in the chapter on politicians and preachers, a double whammy. And I tried to get some of that across to our church, and I haven't met with much success so far. It takes a while.
Well, Red, I know a lot of what you've been listening to is near and dear to your heart. Would you like to respond to Harry's opening comments?
I would like to. I'd like to bring up the counterfeits. You see, our Heavenly Father, if you talk to a theologian and you say, well,
right,
well, can you explain God? And they'll say, well, he's omniscient. He knows everything. He's omnipresent, and he is omnipotent. Three things: omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. Well, communications that we've heard about here, the Facebooks and all this kind of thing, Satan is trying his best to counterfeit the omniscience of the true God, knowing God, our Heavenly Father, our Creator God, knows. He has this omniscience, all-knowing. And so Satan has to try to counterfeit that so that he is all-knowing. The omnipotence, that's why we've got troops in 150-some-odd different countries, you know, trying to intimidate people and that type of thing. And the income tax, years ago, excuse me, years ago, I came to an idea. I said, anytime you read in the scriptures anything that God has planned or ordained or such, don't go on until you identify the satanic counterfeit to what you just read. Now, if you've read in the Bible about the 10% tithe that is recommended there, it's not mandatory, it's voluntary, 10% of your productivity right off of the top to your Creator God. And the income tax is the satanic counterfeit to the God-ordained 10% tithe. Only, you see, I've got this tax audit guide, and Mortimer W. Kaplan, the commissioner of the IRS in 1975, when this tax audit guide came out, he wrote the foreword. The very first line of that foreword says, our tax system is based on individual self-assessment and voluntary compliance. And then they say they don't tell you that there, but if you don't volunteer, you go to jail. And so the word return on the tax, the 1040 return, our 10% tithe is a return to our Creator for His blessings and His promises and all, and what He does for us. And the return on that 1040 comes right from that tithe. And so Every, you know, and of course, he was talking about the churches. I am telling people, if you're part of a denominational religion, talk to your pastor and ask him if he understands what the First Amendment, there's five clauses in the First Amendment, and the one of them is the freedom of religion. And ask your pastor, what does that mean? And he'll say, oh, you got the freedom to be a Mormon or a Methodist or a Baptist or a Catholic or a Muslim or whatever. That is not what that freedom of religion is about in the First Amendment. That is so that your pastor, he has a responsibility at the system that we've got now is so evil. That pastor needs to get up in his pulpit every Sunday morning and tell the congregation, we have a president that is satanic. He is a liar, and we've got to do something about it. And he needs to be teaching his people about jury, their power on the jury and on the grand jury. That's what the freedom of religion is about, because in the First Amendment, five clauses, they're all there to be a check against the system, against the Congress, against the executive branch, against the judiciary. The First Amendment, freedom of speech. We should be able to speak out and say what we want about how bad the government is, and they cannot lash back at us. The freedom of the press. We can write it up in a book and say how bad the government is, and the freedom to assemble. We can go to meetings. And, of course, in Montana, we started having weekly meetings in the Holiday Inn, the convention center in Billings, Montana. We started in the summer of 76, rather. And we had them every week until we found out that the IRS agents were out in the parking lot taking everybody's license numbers, and then they were all getting audited, and we stopped having the meetings. And so they were violating our First Amendment rights to freedom of assembly and the freedom to petition for redress of grievance. We were to be a check. All five clauses of the First Amendment are there as a check in our hands, in our area where we can operate. We can do some of these things, if not all five, at least three or four. Everybody should be involved, and especially the preacher, because the preacher has the attention of that audience.
Yeah. You made a mention of your book, When a Church Gets a 501c3 or an incorporation at the state level, does that blunt our freedom of religion?
What has happened is the preachers, they love the IRS. That I've had preachers confront me and say, we couldn't survive without that tax exemption. And they love signing these tax exempt receipts for the pew warmers that pay their tithes to the church and want a tax receipt so that they can put it on their income tax. The preachers love that. That's why they're not speaking out about the government. They're not speaking out against the Democrats and the Republicans and all the rest of them that are so much a problem. They are not being a check. We were supposed to have a system of checks and balances. And most of the checks rest in our hands, we the people as individuals. An individual on the jury can be a check against 11 people that don't know sic'em about what they're supposed to be doing. One person can be that check.
Yeah.
On the grand juries, one person can educate that grand jury. And we were to have these powers to be a check against a do-nothing Congress, to be a check against a lying president, and be a check against judges who are corkscrew lawyers, and they're beneficiaries of the tax laws. And this is why we lose so many cases in the courts, because they get a bonus. They get bonuses if they get a, you know, if they sit in a case where it's a tax matter or whatever. They get a bonus if the guy has to go to jail, if they destroy the man's business, if they destroy his family, if they steal his property. They get a bonus. And we just find out now that the Veterans Administration, if those people that were managing the management, they were and a bunch of outlaws, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a veteran. And the Veterans Administration, poorly run, very bad. It was a lot of veterans needed help and couldn't get it. And those people that were in the management positions were getting bonuses. Lois Lerner, with the Internal Revenue Service, that's on the hot seat now, she got bonuses, a lot of money. She was high paid to start with. Why are these people getting bonuses? It's an outrage. And so I've said enough here for a bit. I'll let somebody else talk.
Go ahead, Harry.
Where would you like to go next?
Well you talked about...
Go ahead, Terry.
No, Jim, go ahead.
The other thing I was thinking when you were talking earlier, you mentioned all the cases and all the laws that were created in this country, and that it just makes things so complex and complicated, and the laws for what they are. Well, there were some things that I found out about the law, and I'd like to bring these points up, and I'll make it brief. All the law that they used is basically based on words that have different meanings that what you and I think they mean. Like you mentioned the IRS earlier, and if you look up the definition of employee in the IRS code, Section 3401 is the code that defines all words used in the code itself. And it was remarkable under Section 3401C that I found out the definition of employee is actually a state or federal elected official, federal employee, or corporate officer. So anytime you get a form and it says, are you an employee, and you put yes, well, guess what? The word employee that you thought it meant doesn't mean what you think it meant. And another thing I learned, and I've used successfully because I drive the country without a driver's license because I don't need one. And I don't need one because the difference in the definition of the word motor vehicle and automobile and the definition of driver compared to traveler. It is a right in this country to travel the country by automobile. That's if you're traveling by automobile. If you're driving, it's a different definition. You're a driver is a person doing commerce on the highway, and a motor vehicle is an automobile used for commercial purposes. And I won a case in New York basically on this, and also the fact that I redefined some of the definitions that they were using. Well, I didn't redefine it. I just used what New York defined these definitions as, like traffic ticket. Traffic means to be engaged in commerce. That's why if you're trafficking in drugs, well, guess what? Motor vehicle, Section 18 U.S.C. 31 of the Federal Code calls a motor vehicle an automobile used for commercial purposes. So when I got the summons, I just sent it back to him saying the summons is in error, and I told him why, because the definitions of what they were claiming I was doing was wrong, because I was a traveler exercising my right to travel by automobile. And the police, when they pulled me over and stopped me, I pretty much explained that to them. And I said, if you tow my car, I says, you'll be violating two federal laws, 18 U.S.C. 241 and 242. So most of the code out there, which is what it is, it's code and not law. The only real laws in this country is called corpus delicti. And corpus delicti is Latin for body of crime. And it means injury, loss, or harm, and there must be a victim. So in a traffic ticket, if you get a traffic ticket for anything, whether you're driving without a license, where's the injury, loss, and harm, and who's the victim? There must always be a victim. Now, most of the code is based on what they call maritime law, which is engaging in commerce. If you're driving a truck on the road and you're engaged in transporting goods over that road, well, you can't do that because the roads belong to the American people. So, therefore, they must pay for that privilege. So you need a driver's license and you need a motor vehicle, which is the truck or the car or whatever you're using to make money on the road. So just by keeping the summons that they give you, you're being offered, when they give you a summons, you're being offered a contract. And you can deny that contract or you can accept it. If you hang on to it and go to court, now you're in their ball game, okay? When the judge walks in, everybody rises. Well, why? Because do you rise before the king or does the king rise before you? The question is, so if in the court case of Chisholm versus Georgia in 1793, the court ruled that when we kicked the king and queen of England out of this country, we became the kings and queens. So therefore, when you go into court, you're sitting there with your summons in your hand. Okay, you're accepting a contract in the court, and the contract is not fair, and it's not made for you to win. Okay.
Jim, are you still disconnected with your state radio?
Not that I know of.
Well, you should be. Remember, it's past the hour. And we have Terry Talbot's going to talk about solutions with two book reviews. We hadn't even started the two book reviews, and we've discussed these issues that we're discussing now many times on our show before. I would like us to get on and let Harry Talbot talk about his two book reviews with solutions.
Okay, that's fine.
Good. I wish I knew where I could get a citizen handbook that would, I could pass out to my friends that would give a lot of this information out that you gentlemen have presented, because most people don't have the time to research it and to practice it, or the courage.
There are some folks working on that, and some of those will probably be coming to visit you in October.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. That'd be great. I'll be looking forward to it. I was speaking of what Doug said. We were talking about one of the things that I've done is kind of unconventional. I told you about my power library, and so one time I was involved in a strike. That's when I was on the other side. I used to be a Roosevelt Democrat, and I was on a teacher's negotiating team, and we used the book The True Believer by Eric Hoffer to get a strike put it together. And everything Hoffer said that would bring people together in a mass movement and enable us to control them worked. So we had a successful 8-day strike and got everything we wanted. And today, if I were involved in the school system again, I'd be on the other side. But we had some cases where we did things like we threw out a marketing order here because it was kind of oppressive, and there was in order to throw it out, we had this was with our fruit, we had a state level marketing order, and the National Marketing Order. And so what we did was we used The Art of War by Sun Tzu as kind of our handbook, and when we used something like this on page 26, it says, you see, Sun Tzu never lost a battle, and it's kind of interesting. He said this is the way you think and plan and make sure that you have the greatest tactics result in not having to go to war at all. So he says you can be sure of succeeding in your attacks if you only attack places that are undefended. You can ensure the safety of your defense if you only hold positions that cannot be attacked. That general is skillful in attack whose opponent does not know what to defend, and he is skillful in defense whose opponent does not know what to attack. And so they have the statement that all warfare is based on deception. And let me see if I can find that reference here. All warfare is based on deception. And I figure this power struggle we're in is a form of warfare. And,
did we lose
and so
somebody?
People need to... How's that? Hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. Hold out the bait, entice the enemy, feign disorder, and crush him. And so we've used that tactic many times in public hearings with success, you know, that the enemy did not know what to attack or where to attack us. The enemy did not know what our objectives were in many cases, and it gives you a lot of strength. So my experience has kind of been in a little different way. I've probably been at 200 hearings in my life on land use issues, and what we were trying to do was we were trying to save our unique prime and unique orchard lands here in the Palisade area, and we were under lots of pressure, and so we had to outthink them. And I remember I could tell you a lot of war stories, but I wanted to get into this 48 Laws of Power and explain what that is. The 48 Laws of Power was written by Green and Elfers, and I happened onto this book a few years ago, and I have read it extensively and consider that it is a book that has, it's like a toolbox, it has 48 tools in it, and when you're fighting a battle, you need to use the correct tools. And so one night I came up with a saying. I said, those who would control you must prevent you from seeking truth. And I felt like that was a huge insight. And so then I wrote down what I call the Bible says the truth will set you free. Well, how do you know what truth is and what it isn't? And so I tell kids that there are three things that you need to know in your life. And, of course, this is an oversimplification. But the first one is you need to know who's lying to you and who's telling you the truth. So I teach them 8 steps that I have on how do you determine if something is true or not true, and how do you practice that in your life. And then it's kind of like that court thing that you were talking about. When you go into court, you think the words mean something, and they mean something else. And you think that the law that's in the court is the law there is. You know, you don't realize that you're being sucked into somebody else's system. And then another thing that I figured there's a guy named Dave Grossman, and Dave Grossman is he calls himself the evangelist, and he teaches police forces how to, well, when somebody has to kill somebody or something in the line of duty, how do they think about it in such a way that they don't lose that person to the police force, or and so on. So he says we need to hunt down every aspect of denial in our lives and prepare ourselves to the utmost for our ability for the reality of the world we live in. And I like that we need to hunt down every aspect of denial in our lives. So I think that's a good launching point. This 48 Laws of Power, I would like to just read you what a few of them are so that you'll see what they are. And then if you want me to elaborate on one of them, the first one is never outshine the master. Never put too much trust in friends. Learn how to use enemies. And that's one that I've used a great deal with good success. Law 3, conceal your intentions. Law 4, always say less than is necessary, which I'm not good at. Law 5, so much depends on your reputation. Guard it with your life. Law 6, court attention at all costs, and it goes on like that. And get others to do the work for you, but always take the credit. Law 9, make other people come to you. Use bait if necessary. Law 9, win through your actions, never through argument. Law 10, avoid the unhappy and the unlucky. 11, learn how to keep people dependent on you. And you see, these are very practical, common sense laws, and they do not build fortresses to protect yourself. Isolation is necessary. And then enter action with boldness. Plan all the way to the end. Make your accomplishments seem effortless. Control the options. Get others to play the cards you deal. The Democratic Party's been pretty good at doing that. Discover each man's thumbscrew or, you know, weakness. What does the man fear? Master the art of timing. Disdain things you cannot have. Ignoring them is the best revenge. And then what they do in this law is they start out with what they call the judgment. And like in Law 13, it says, when asking for help, appeal to people's self-interest, never their mercy or gratitude. And it says the judgment is if you need to turn to an ally for help, do not bother to remind him of your past assistance and good deeds. He will find a way to ignore you. Instead, uncover something in your request or in your alliance with him that will benefit him and emphasize it all out of proportion. He will respond enthusiastically when he sees something to be gained for himself. And many people are tempted to win somebody over by saying, look what I've done for you. And this says it doesn't work. And there are, then it goes through, you know, it will usually tell a number of historical cases of where this law has been used and how it works, and then it has a section called observance to the law, and then keys to power. And the keys to power in this one would be, in your quest for power, you will constantly find yourself in a position of asking for help from those more powerful than you. There is an art to asking for help, an art that depends on your ability to understand the person you are dealing with and not to confuse your needs with theirs. Most people never succeed at this because they are completely trapped in their own wants and desires. They start from the assumption that people they are appealing to have a selfless interest in helping them. And you can see how practical these things are. And so I have read this book until it has fallen apart almost. And so, you know, any of you have any questions, or do you want me to emphasize certain things in here?
Well, I heard some things, and maybe I misheard some things. It seemed to me that there was some deception involved.
Some of these are very deceptive. Yeah. And so that's why I say that if your principles and ethics do not allow you to use one of these tools, you just don't use it. But saying less than is necessary is probably one everybody can do, for example. You know, in other words, don't, the more you talk, you know, a guy told me 2 nights ago, he said, I got a traffic ticket. And he said, I told the cop how important I was in the county and that I had been, they had thought to have me be a county sheriff at one time. They were going to ask me. And then the guy had a jury trial, so he said when he went to the jury trial, the cop used all of his stuff against him and distorted his statement. So he learned the lesson that he should not have said very much. Is that okay for an answer?
Well,
yeah, I believe it is.
In my case, what I would have done is sent the ticket back in. Across the ticket, I would have written, I do not agree to these proceedings, and I do not wish to contract with the court. From that point on,
yeah.
When you send it back in, they can't do anything. And the reason being is because of the fact that in order for them to render a judgment, there has to be an agreement on both ends to use that summons, which is a contract. Okay,
yeah.
And my sister got out of a speeding ticket that way, too. But the bottom line is you don't go into the court in the first place because no law has been broken, only code. And you're not subject to the code because the flag of that court is a maritime flag. And we're not under maritime
jurisdiction. Exactly, with the gold fringe on it, right?
Right. That's a commercial court. And if you don't contract, there's no commercial law involved. So that's the whole emphasis. And if you do go to court, first
thing
you do
is challenge.
That's
why we need that stuff in the handbook, you know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I learned this the hard way myself, you know.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of people will never learn the lesson, though, correctly. You know, this guy I talked to, he was a smart guy. He'd been around. He just wasn't being wise. But we had about 8 meetings here last winter on what we called citizen law, and we had some different speakers, but we didn't get very far. We learned a lot of things, but we realized that we need to learn a lot more. And you know, the question is to go back to Terry's question, part of the answer to these things is, you may not want to do one of these, carry out one of these laws, but you may sense that somebody's doing it to you. So how do you arm yourself against their guile,
right,
and trickery, see? And we know I'm reminded when I
tried to teach someone that when they go in for jury duty, that they cannot reveal all of what they know or their opinions, because they'll be removed from the jury and they'll be blocked from being able to judge the law. And they were uncomfortable,
exactly,
with that. So I said to them, I said, okay, you're in Nazi Germany, and you've got this family with small children hiding in your cellar under your floor. And they come to your door, and they knock on your door, and you know that they're looking to kill people and put them into concentration camps, and they ask you if you've got anybody hidden in your house. What are you going to tell them?
Yeah, very good. Very good. And then
you want to get those kids killed? That's a question. What do you think your creator's gonna want you to do?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you betcha. I'll take my chances on doing the right thing. Well, you know, there was a guy ran for office here for the House of Representatives in Colorado, and he didn't do very well, but he ran on principles, and I got to thinking. And there's another guy I'm working with that's running on principles, too, and I'm saying, you know, I told him, I said, you like to fish, and you like strawberries, but you don't put strawberries on your hook. So I'm asking you the question as to whether it would be better to, you know, kind of campaign, give the fish what they want, and then there would be a principled man in the legislature. So what would you say to that?
I'm in that situation right now with choosing someone to fill a vacancy for a candidacy, and one of the people who are wanting to fill that vacancy has been asking me to provide them with information to read about things, you know, truths, and I had to say to them, these are not things you want to be talking about right now, and you don't even want to bring these things up until you're elected. I had no problem saying that to them, and they had no problem accepting what I said. But if you go out there and you tell people while you're running for election that you're aware of somebody that came in under Operation Paperclip, or that you know that they're a shill within the party, and you start attacking people that are trusted in the general eyes of the general public, even though you know they're corrupt, and you're trying to get elected, you're going to lose votes, and you're not going to get yourself into office. So there's no question that a person running for office has to not say everything they know. If they do, they will not get elected.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to think too. What is the electorate? What message would you give them that would make them want to elect you, and feel that they were better off with you in office? You gotta live with your conscience, but I'm saying, you know, we've got to get elected.
Harry, have you been listening at all to Bill Whittle?
I have. Occasionally somebody sends me one.
Well, Bill Whittle,
he has a video
thing that's called Afterburner. But he also does what he calls the virtual Mr. President. So he actually acts like he's the president, and he invites people to ask him questions, and he gives them answers in such a way that the average swing voter, for example, would not reject his comments and not look at him negatively, but would embrace him and vote for him, yet his answers are totally truthful. And
so
I think
that's
I think it's
technique there.
Yes, it is. So all we have to really do is use a little finesse about the things that we talk about and select our talking points, and be a little bit smart about that, and not go negative, but let people go negative on their own by the questions you ask.
Yeah.
Using the power of questions is a tremendous tool in handling those kind of situations. Lead people to their thoughts.
Yeah.
Don't try to ramble down their throat.
That's what I'm going to tell this guy tomorrow. I because he's not been real receptive, and I feel like I haven't done a good job convincing him. Yeah, most people who run for office aren't good at asking questions and finding out what people want. They're good at talking and telling people what they want.
from the biblical standpoint, be gentle as a dove, yet wise as a serpent. And the serpent's always ready to strike, but he never shows his true colors because his personage is of the dove.
Okay, I'm writing this down. That's good. I hadn't thought about that in that context. You know,
one of the things that I've learned, Harry. Go ahead, Harry.
No, I'm listening to you right now.
One of the things that I've learned is that I've never found a truth in a secular writing that I could not find in the scriptures.
Wow.
I have learned that every truth out there exists in those scriptures. So it's a test. If you want to know whether something is the truth or not, you should be able to find it in the scripture. If you can't, it's probably not the truth.
Right. Right. All right. That's good. I think that when you study the laws of power, you also should use the Bible and the scriptures as your compass and your guide in what to do.
I call it a lens.
Okay.
Because you need to see things through that lens.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of one of these laws that you might be able to do that with. It's law number 40, despise the free lunch. And what is offered free is dangerous. It usually involves either a trick or a hidden obligation. What has worth is worth paying for. By paying your own way, you stay clear of gratitude, guilt, and deceit. It is also often wise to pay the full price. There is no cutting corners with excellence. Be lavish with money and keep it circulating, for generosity is a sign and a magnet for power. And then I wrote a note here, indiscriminate generosity often results in contempt rather than gratefulness. So you're not being indiscriminate, you're being fair. And if a person is thought of as being cheap or willing to take advantage of other people, you free yourself from a lot of problems. And it says, in the realm of power, everything must be judged by its cost. Everything has a price. What is offered free at bargain rates often comes with a psychological price tag. Complicated feelings of obligation compromises with quality. The insecurity those compromises bring on and on. The powerful learn early to protect their most valuable resources, independence, and move to it gives you independence and room to maneuver. By paying the full price, they keep themselves free of dangerous entanglements. And one of the things I practice a lot of times when somebody offers me something at a reduced price, I say, no, you've got to, you know, you're in business, so I'll pay the price. And so I do, and what it does is that it makes them trust me. And, and a lot of times I particularly do this with my enemies. I make sure with my enemies that I'm always fair and courteous. If I go someplace with an enemy, I try to do the little favors for them, like open a door, help them carry books, see to it that the room is the right temperature, and all of these things. And that has a biblical basis. You know, it talks about being kind to your enemies, heaping burning coals upon their head. I never saw anybody's head with smoke coming out of it, but it's served me pretty well when I did that. And then it says the powerful understand that money is psychologically charged, that is also a vessel of politeness and sociability. They make the human side of money a weapon in their armory. And then in the delusion, in this delusion, power requires self-discipline. The prospect of wealth, particularly easy sudden wealth, plays havoc with the emotions. The sudden rich believe that more is always possible. The free lunch, the money that will fall into your lap is just around the corner. In this delusion, the greedy neglect everything. Power really depends on self-control, the goodwill of others, and so on. So you want to make sure that when you are dealing with people, whether particularly, I think particularly my friends and my supporters, I never lie to them knowingly or cheat them or belittle them or anything like that. So one of the things that I do in the game of power is that I build up a support group. And these are people that, where there's total trust required and total integrity. And we have that kind of group pretty much in our Mesa County Patriots, and those of us who are trying to get the roads open in Mesa County, you know, on BLM land that they've closed, and I think we're being very smart about that, and we're working with the county people, and we're going to be able to do this without breaking any laws. So I went off the subject there, but I wanted to get that point in.
Well, again, if you look at Scripture, you'll find those principles. How often was Paul, the Apostle Paul, or Shaul is his real name, how often did he, when he, in his writings, did he say, did I burden you when I was with you? He's always talking about, you should trust me because I never burdened you. I always earned my keep when I was there. He advised those that he was teaching to do that, the same thing. You look at when the prophets were sent to a person's home. Look at how they always blessed that home. They always, you know, if you've got a little bit of oil, you know, pour it into 20 other containers, and you'll still have some left over. You know, and it also talks about people that don't work shouldn't eat. And the other thing is that look at the counterfeit, like Red talked about. The counterfeiters.
Thank you for dropping me off at the bus stop at 10. I have 11 o'clock.
I'm hearing somebody talking in the background. Sounds like Doug. You might want to mute yourself if you're not involved in the conversation. Also, look at who our enemy is. I believe it was Horace Greeley. I think it was Horace Greeley that made the comment: the darkest day in human history was when a man discovered that he could get his daily bread without earning it, basically. I forget the exact words, but it what it amounts to is that you can earn your keep by off of the sweat of another man's brow instead of your own.
Yeah.
And how dark of a day that was. Well, that's precisely what the counterfeiters do. That's exactly what they do. They have always and are living off of the sweat of the working man's brow. They don't work for it. They don't provide any intrinsic value, but yet they expect it to be treated like they're elite. And that's what our enemy does. That's a destructive process because it's basically stealing the production of others. It's theft, which is the basis of most law.
I think that one of the great deceptions that we have is that there are people called the ruling class or the elites. And my father, who was one generation closer to the good United States, would never even give any respect to a person because of their position. To him, all men were created equal, and he lived that way. And and I'm trying to do that myself. You know, when I talk to a senator or somebody in a position of power, I talk straight across to them. And so I don't talk up to them or down to them. And I consider them as citizens so-and-so. And we tend to want to tack titles on everybody that we think we can tack a title onto. And I think that's one of the things that we've got to overcome if we're going to be sovereign citizens again, that we never look up to anybody. And this thing about standing up when the judge comes in and everybody says, "All rise," you know, that's one of those things. When a lawyer puts Esquire in front of his name, that's one of those things. When anybody tries to elevate themselves above another, I think that's something that, you know, I feel so disappointed that the churches don't teach a lot of these lessons, but churches are just kind of, most churches are just kind of tepid, you know. It's kind of Christianity light, and I hate to be so critical, but I have not heard a sermon in my whole life against the killing of babies in the womb. And I think that's a huge issue.
Well, we've had some gentlemen on this program over the past few years. John Weaver is one of those. Robert McCurry is another one. Jim Grove, who is now passed, but you know, these
now,
are
Jim
gentlemen
Grove,
who have preached boldly.
Okay.
No, he was
yeah.
a pastor in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
He was.
Okay.
These are all guys that are part of the unregistered churches. These are guys who have been out there preaching against the 501c3s.
Yeah.
But they have boldly spoken about the abortion problem and the fact that we've killed off our workforce and you know what kind of a crime and sin this has been, and they've chastised a lot of other preachers and pastors for not bringing this forward from the pulpit to their membership.
Yeah. Did you call these unregistered churches?
Yes.
Okay, and so how does a church go from being registered to unregistered?
Well, one of the things I found out is that it's easier to start unregistered than it is to become unregistered.
Yeah. We had that talk some when you were at our house. Yeah.
It's kind of like somebody who's now a resident alien and subject to the USA Inc., subject to the taxation, who's already getting W-2 and 1099 income. It's much more difficult for them to starve the beast by not volunteering to participate in their tithe to Satan. It's a lot easier for someone who does not have W-2 income or has not filed a 1040 and doesn't get 1099s, because then a flag is never raised to them, so they don't come looking
okay.
for you. And the same
yeah.
thing is true for a church. If you start a church and you never get involved, never raise that flag to them, it's a lot
yeah.
easier than if all of a sudden you cut off that report.
Yeah. Yeah, see, one of the things we're facing right now, we're trying to start a school that our church would sponsor, I guess. It would be kind of a school that supports homeschooling, you know, where the kids had come together a couple times a week, and we're looking at, you know, do we need to do any of that 501c3 stuff or anything? And so that's a question we're dealing with now.
Well, go find the law that says you have to do it.
And I can't find it, right?
Exactly. Doesn't exist.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it doesn't stop them from persecuting you if they get wind of it. But and they'll try to use the police state tactics on you and threaten you and coerce you into it. But the fact is that the law is not there. There was never this actually came into being with President Johnson.
Yes.
In the 60s is when this actually got to be a thing where they deceived the churches into believing that they had to do this. Before that, the churches were never, they weren't, you know, they didn't go and get this tax-exempt status prior to that, and there was no law put into place that said they had to.
Yeah, the First Amendment gave them that status, right?
Right.
Okay.
Actually, it wasn't the First Amendment that gave them the status. It was the First Amendment that reserved that status. None of us got any rights granted to us by the Bill of
Rights. Right. Right.
So.
That's a wonderful way to put it, and I'll remember that. We reserved it. The right came from God.
Yes.
Here's a law that you could probably, anybody could probably agree with, master the art of timing. Never seem to be in a hurry. Hurrying betrays a lack of control over yourself and over time. Always seem patient, as if you know something. Know that everyone will come to you eventually. Become a detective of the right moment. Sniff out the spirit of the time, the trends that will carry you to power. Learn to stand back when the time is not ripe and strike fiercely when it has reached fruition. And, of course, this is kind of a lifelong thing that that we learn, you know, is the art of timing. And I have a saying that if you do the right thing at the wrong time, you've done the wrong thing. And, you know, history is full of examples of people who have been ahead of their time and people have not accepted them, whereas 20 or 40 years later, they would be very accepting and people would be ready. So that's kind of hard to do, but it says time is an artificial concept that we ourselves have created to make the limitlessness of eternity and the universe more bearable, more human. And that's kind of an interesting way to put it. It says the first thing to do is to understand the mastering of the art of timing. If the upper inner turmoil caused by our emotions tends to make time move faster, it follows that once we control our emotional responses, events will move much more slowly. The altered way of dealing with things tends to lengthen our perception of future times and opens up possibilities that fear and anger close off and allows the patience that is the principal requirement of the art of timing. And this is a pretty profound thing. It says you do not, waiting involves controlling not only your own emotions, but those of your colleagues who, mistaking action for power, may try to push you into making rash moves, I'm sorry. And it says you do not deliberately slow time down to live longer or to take more pleasure in the moment, but the better to play the game of power. First, when your mind is uncluttered by constant emergencies, you will see that further into the future. Second, you will be able to resist the baits that people dangle in front of you and keep yourself from becoming another impatient sucker. You know, the world is full of things that says, you know, if you call in the next 20 minutes, you'll get a certain deal, or it won't be long before all of these things are gone, and so on. And life is full of those things. But if you feel you get stronger by feeling that there's nothing you have to have, and so then you can do things on your terms instead of on the other person's terms. And my dad used to say, don't play another man's game. If you play another man's game, he'll probably win because it's his game. And I followed that all my life, and that's kept me out of a lot of big problems. So, you know, that makes you more powerful. And I really believe that that anyone can get up tomorrow morning and start the quest of becoming more powerful. And then, for example, if you disdain things that you cannot have, by acknowledging a petty problem, you give it existence and credibility. The more attention you pay to an enemy, the stronger you make him. And a small mistake is often made worse and more visible when you try to fix it. It is sometimes best to leave things alone. If there is something that you cannot have, show contempt for it. The less interest you reveal, the more superior you seem. And then I'm skipping around here to things I've highlighted. It said, remember, you choose to let things bother you. You can just as easily choose not to notice an irritating offender, to consider the matter trivial and unworthy of your interest. That is a powerful move. What you do not react to cannot drag you down. I got to repeat that. What you do not react to cannot drag you down in a futile engagement. Your pride is not involved. The best lesson you can teach an irritating ad is to consign it to oblivion by ignoring it. If it is impossible to ignore, then conspire in a secret way to do away with it, but never inadvertently draw attention to the bothersome insect that will go away or die on its own. If you waste time and energy in such an entanglement, it is your own fault. Learn to play card of disdain and turn your back on what you cannot harm, what cannot harm you in the long run. And I think that's pretty profound, and that's one of my favorites.
Well, I just had several moments of the Holy Spirit saying to me, have you heard this before? Have I told you this? Have you heard it from me? Have you heard it from your own wisdom? How many times do I have to say this to you? Is it getting through? Is it sinking in? Harry, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Where, or a better question is, when do we encounter the Creator? Do we encounter him in the past or in the future, or do we encounter him only in the present?
Well, my reaction would be, since I ask for the guidance of the Holy Spirit every day, that we encounter him in the present.
Exactly. That element alone matches up with all of the things that you just said.
And if the Holy Spirit can guide you, see, I believe he's guided me to get to know you guys, you know, because that's been important in my life.
I wish I could remember that old. There was an old Hebrew proverb that I wish I could remember the exact words of. It basically amounted to that if you push time, it will push back against you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very hard for me because my joke with my wife is I've never prayed for patience and I never got any. Why would anyone want patience? See? And of course she comes back at me. She's a lot more laid back and patient than I am. So that's been a personal battle with me, the timing thing. And there's another thing that is a huge issue, and I think this is good for young people to learn. There's a law that says think as you like, but behave as others. And it's kind of an interesting thing. If somebody reads this book, they'll get the whole content of it. It says, in one of the things I've highlighted is the reason arguments do not work is that most people hold their ideas and values without thinking about them. There is a strong emotional content in their beliefs. They really do not want to have to rework their habit of thinking. And when you challenge them, whether directly through your arguments or indirectly through your behavior, they are hostile. And then that was one of the most important statements in the book to me, why arguments don't work. You know, you hear these guys arguing on programs and stuff, and neither of them convinces the other. I've never heard somebody say, wow, you know, I hadn't thought of that. You know, I believe you're right. Not one time.
Harry, I'm going to invite Red to make a few closing comments here. We've got about 8 minutes left to go
great.
In the show. And we've got about 8 minutes left, so I'm going to give Red a few minutes here, and then I'm going to turn it back to you to give your closing comments to close us out for the show. Is that a fair way to approach it?
That'll be good as long as you give him a lot of time and me a short time.
Red, are you still with us?
I'm still here. I haven't gone anyplace. I noticed different ones talking about case and statute of law and all of that, and I thought when I run into a lawyer, when I talk to a lawyer, I love to ask him a question. I like to ask him, say, well, what is the highest court in our land? And of course you get a standard answer, well, the Supreme Court. And I tell him, well, I'm sorry, but you're wrong. Wrong? You know, that comes as a real jolt to them. And you can do this with patriots. You can do this with a lot of the, the people that really believe that they're freedom fighters or whatever. And you explain to them that the highest court in our land is a 12-person common law grand jury as per the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. And you will find that they don't teach the 7th Amendment in the law schools. They spend a lot of time on the 1st Amendment. They spend weeks studying the 1st Amendment, weeks studying the 4th and the 5th. That's the three that are the great. They're the great love of the civil libertarians. The 7th article of the Bill of Rights is the most important of all. Of all of these 10 articles of the Bill of Rights, the 7th is by far the most important because that is where we exercise our sovereignty. And that is the highest court in the land because the Supreme Court cannot re-examine the rulings, the findings of that 7th Amendment common law jury. And you don't want to forget that the 9 justices of the Supreme Court are all paid salaries from tax money. That means that they have a conflict of interest in all cases having anything to do. If there's a controversy of over $20 between the individual and any agency of government, that conflict of interest is something that is going to be the tool that you have to use to keep those judges from making rules and findings of fact that they don't have the right to do. So teach your patriot friends and everything about this highest court of the land. It is the Seventh Amendment jury. And I think that is so vital, and it's something that we missed for many years in the freedom movement. I talked about it 20 years ago, and people just didn't seem to want to hear what I was saying. But now we're in a much more desperate situation nationwide with the debt and all of that. And it's time that we wake up and get a little better informed, and don't get carried off with case and statute law, because it isn't law at all. It's just stuff that has been created by a bunch of lawyers and judges, lawyer judges, and don't get off on that track. And I never will forget, this is kind of humorous. I ran for governor in Montana in 1988, and I ran as a Democrat. And I said, I'm a Jeffersonian Democrat, and if the other candidates, the six candidates that were running, I said, if you don't agree with Thomas Jefferson, then I just have to assume that you are Karl Marx Democrats. And of course, that didn't go across too strong, but anyway, I'll never forget that, a statewide television debate put on by the state college. And we drew straws to see what order, and I was number 5 out of 6, where I was pretty comfortable. And there was a lady there from the League of Women Vipers, voters, and she asked the question. She said the federal government is spending money, and they're trying to help single-parent families get along better and be able to raise their families. And she said, if you were to be governor, what would you do at the state level to go work with the federal? And I'll never forget it. The first four candidates, they all said, if I was governor, I'd cooperate with the federal government. That's a great need, and the taxpayers of this state, we don't think that the taxpayers would rebel spending a little money for something good like that. And then it was my turn to speak, and I said, I can't imagine why anybody would have anything to do with the U.S. Congress. I said, they are the worst child abusers in history. They have put a debt on every child born. Even before they're born, they've got a debt that's going to face them when they get out in the world. And I said, that is child abuse of the most evil and the worst kind that there is. I brought down the House. I was in the polls showing that I was going to win the Democratic primary. And I came in 5th because the vote fraud across the state was so bad. You see, that beast. I like that calling, talking about the beast. That beast. I think the people from Chicago come out to Montana to learn how to do vote fraud. And so, anyway, I think that's kind of a humorous thing that happened. And I really didn't want to be governor, but I did raise a lot of cane. I did cause a lot of waves, and so it's been a good program tonight, and I'm sure glad that you are all on here tonight, and the good Lord bless you all.
Thank you, Red. Harry, you've only got about 1 minute.
Okay, I just wanted to say that we as individuals have to turn this thing around. And we know that we've been brainwashed, and we know that the psychopaths and sociopaths that have run the world for centuries now have new tools to control us, and we need to understand that their most potent weapon is the mind of the oppressed, And if we are the, we no longer should count ourselves among the oppressed. When I wake up every morning, I say it's good to be king. I think of myself as a sovereign citizen. I've taken control of my own mind. I want others to do the same. And I appreciate talking with you guys tonight because I know that you're in that category, and together we're going to find new tools and move forward and win this battle someday.
Make it so, Harry, and thank you for joining us tonight. You've been a great guest, and we really appreciate you very much. You're always welcome here at Walls in Our Minds. Have a great night. We'll see everyone next week at Walls in Our Minds.
Thank you very much.
He is able, more